On the morning of the 13th of March, the government confirmed that it intends to eliminate 87% of tariffs on goods imported into Britain, but only if the UK leaves the EU without a deal, and only for an initial 12-month period. And as we record this podcast, MPs seem intent on ruling out a no-deal Brexit. Critics of any form of unilateral tariff reduction usually focus on one or more of three concerns: the risk to jobs, the threat to standards, and the potential loss of leverage in future trade negotiations. Many have claimed that UK manufacturing and agriculture would be devastated by a flood of cheap imports. Any reduction in trade barriers, unilaterally or multilaterally, is likely to cause job losses, and that will be incredibly painful for the minority who are adversely affected. But does free trade necessarily mean you can't compensate losers and reduce tariffs without lowering standards? And should our post-Brexit ambition be to eliminate the bulk of our remaining tariffs as soon as possible, deal or no deal? Joining me to discuss is the IEA's Economics Fellow, Julian Jessop, and Senior Counsel to the IEA's International Trade Unit, Victoria Hewson. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Darren.
Hi there.
Julian, do you want to start us off by, do you think there's any justifiable concern about getting rid of 87% of our tariffs?
I think there's a lot of project fear here, to coin a phrase. Those people that suggest that UK manufacturing and agriculture might be wiped out by a flood of cheap foreign imports, well, for a start, they're not saying a great deal about the quality of the goods that we produce in this country. Are they really saying that many of our industries are only propped up by the subsidies that tariff provide? I also think they're not saying much about UK consumers. There seems to be a presumption that UK consumers will just buy the goods that are cheapest, regardless of quality. If indeed it is the case that UK goods are of high quality at a good price, then UK consumers will continue to buy them. I think the question needs to be turned around. You know, what are the circumstances in which it is right to subsidise an industry which somehow is uncompetitive, or at least where we fail to have any comparative advantage? I think there might be a few cases where some form of subsidy is appropriate. I'm thinking in particular of farming, where there might be wider social benefits from good farming practices that protect the environment. There might be arguments about security of supply, both in farming and in manufacturing as well, if the alternative is a flood of goods that are being dumped on the UK market at below cost that ultimately drive UK producers out of business, and in the long run we end up paying higher prices than we would otherwise have done. But these are very much the exception. I think almost all economists would agree that free trade is good for the economy as a whole. And while there might be losers in the short run, we have lots of means to compensate them and still leave the economy as a whole better off.
So why would free trade be good for the UK post-Brexit? Why are you so passionate about the UK deal or no deal embarking upon a free trade strategy?
Well, there are a number of ways that the wider economy will benefit from lower tariffs. First of all, we need to put consumers first. And if consumers have more choice and lower prices as a result of reducing import tariffs, then they're happier, but also they have more money to spend on other goods and services, including those produced at home. It's worth stressing that many businesses, of course, are also major importers. They import parts and components that may well end up cheaper, or they import products that they themselves are trying to sell. So if those products are cheaper, that's a benefit to them as well. Even in very sensitive areas where jobs might be lost, it is worth stressing that in the long run, it's better to have jobs that are in sectors where the UK does have a genuine edge. It does have some comparative advantage, rather than sectors that are being propped up in the short term only by artificial subsidies, including tariffs. So I think in the long run, lowering tariffs is good for jobs as well. But while recognising you do need to look after those people who in the short run might lose, but as I say, we've got plenty of ways of doing that.
Victoria, eliminating tariffs, surely, as far as trade negotiations are concerned, we're going to lose our bargaining chip, aren't we, if we get rid of tariffs and reduce them to zero?
Well, that's a very commonly held view, and it certainly seems to be one of the reasons why the particular tariff items have been singled out to have tariffs kept on them, in particular agriculture, some clothing items, and a few others. And it would seem partly, obviously, to protect domestic producers. Mm. That's certainly the case with agriculture and the particular agricultural items that will retain their protection, in particular beef, lamb, and similar mm-hmm. products. But frankly, it's really not the case that you need to have high tariffs in order to trade them away for to reach agreement with other countries. You just have to look at some of the most successful countries in the world at reaching free trade agreements with other countries. New Zealand springs to mind, and Singapore, who have low or no tariffs at all. And you certainly could never argue that having very open home markets with very few tariffs at all, 99% of goods are allowed to enter Singapore without accruing any import duties. That certainly hasn't held them back from reaching very successful free trade agreements with lots of countries.
Mm. But on that point, you mentioned agriculture. In the event of a no-deal scenario, agriculture is a real issue as far as avoiding a hard border on the island of Ireland is concerned, isn't it?
It is, and the solution that the government has published this morning for the Irish border in a no-deal situation is certainly somewhat unorthodox from a trade law perspective. And it's come in for a lot of criticism, which I must say I'm not sure all the criticism is fair. So what the solution comprises is basically saying that although the UK as a whole will apply a certain range of tariffs mm-hmm. to imports, those tariffs will not apply on goods that enter Northern Ireland from the Republic of Ireland. So there's essentially a 100% exemption from duties.
Doesn't that undercut business in Northern Ireland?
Well, this is one of the criticisms that a lot of business groups and commentators have raised today. It's certainly fair to say that for Northern Irish exporters who send their goods to the Republic of Ireland, they will suffer if the Republic of Ireland, as seems highly likely, has to impose the common external tariff on imports, because Northern Ireland will form part of a third country and the common external tariff will apply. So for Northern Irish businesses who export to the Republic of Ireland, that will be quite negative for them. However, the suggestion that they will somehow also suffer from competition in their home market from Irish businesses who benefit from zero tariffs coming into Northern Ireland, I don't think that stacks up, because that's already the case. Mm-hmm. We're not introducing a new benefit for Irish exporters to Northern Ireland because mm-hmm. they already have zero tariffs. All we're doing is maintaining the same, which actually gives Northern Irish businesses an advantage over businesses in the Republic. It sort of makes Northern Ireland a free trade zone in many ways, which is extremely positive for businesses and, above all, consumers in Northern Ireland.
Julian, you write in your piece about the probability of job losses, and you do mention that some industries will definitely be impacted if we do eliminate tariffs. How big are we talking? Will that be George Osborne's predicted 800,000 job losses if we were to do this?
Well, first of all, I think it's worth saying that any worthwhile policy that has a major impact on the economy is likely to create some losers as well as winners. If your criterion was always that jobs must be protected, every single job, then I don't think you'd ever end up doing anything. In terms of the numbers, I think they would be relatively small. I would say potentially tens or hundreds of thousands of jobs at risk. That's not a trivial number, but in the context of an economy that employs more than 30 million, and the economy does lose and create hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of jobs every single year. So this sort of turnaround is not unusual. If you go back, you know, 100, 200 years ago, a third of the British population, for example, used to be employed in agriculture. Almost all of those have now been redeployed to other sectors. In the 1920s, we had close to a million people working in coal mining, who by and large have all now found other jobs. So I think the economy is actually pretty good at creating jobs to replace any that are that are lost. There's probably more that we can do here, and I think it's very important that, you know, we keep labour markets flexible and housing markets flexible to make it easy for people to move from one job or one part of the country to another. It's very important to maintain a favourable business environment, to encourage entrepreneurship, to make it more attractive for people to set up companies, to employ workers who've been released from less competitive sectors where we don't really have an edge. So there are still things that need to be done to make sure that people can move from one sector to another. But given that overall the economy would be better off with a policy of lower trade barriers, it shouldn't be beyond the wit of man or woman to think of means of compensating the losers and still leaving everybody else better off.
I think in one particular sector that's had a lot of attention from the perspective of preserving jobs, that's done very well out of this particular announcement on tariffs is the automotive sector, the car makers, who I would imagine should be pretty happy that they've retained the full tariff on imports of cars to this country of, I think it's 10.6%. But the government has announced that they will be eliminating the tariff on car parts. So that's, you know, that's a bit of a boost actually for the manufacturers in this country. They have their domestic market protected. They have tariffs will apply on cars imported from the EU, which is a blow for the consumer. There's no doubt about that. I think it was calculated that the average increase on the price of a car imported from the EU would be about £1,500, which is a material amount. And so, but this is a great example of how the very existence of tariffs gives government a way of intervening in the market in a way that is very susceptible to the voices of incumbent vested interests. And I think the way the automotive industry and agriculture has been protected in this round of tariff announcements really illustrates that very clearly. Not that I'm against the automotive industry in this country. I think it's, you know, it's been a huge success story and long may it continue. But as Julian suggests, I think we have to hope and expect, in fact, that an industry that is genuinely high quality and competitive doesn't need tariffs to prop it up.
But Julian, can't you see that Brexit is already having a massive impact on the UK's manufacturing sector? You could even say it's going to kill it. Look at the way that Nissan is stopping production of models, various models of cars now. The people that voted for Brexit up in Sunderland are going to suffer the most from these policies, aren't they?
Well, there's no doubt that Brexit uncertainty has harmed the economy overall. I mean, the fall in the pound has pushed up inflation and reduced consumer spending power. And the business sector is holding back on investment that it might otherwise have done because it simply doesn't know what our long-term trading relationship with the EU is going to be. So in aggregate, yes, the economy has probably grown more slowly than it would otherwise have done. But I think a lot of the individual stories are exaggerated, particularly stories from the car sector. I mean, the reality is that the car sector in the UK, but across Europe and indeed globally, is going through a large number of structural changes to do with the switch, for example, from diesel towards electric cars. There's been a collapse in demand, particularly in key markets like China. So the car sector would be struggling anyway, and actually it's struggling at least as much in other countries like Germany as it is in the UK. If we look at some of the specific announcements that have been made, I mean, Nissan's decision, for example, not to make the X-Trail in Sunderland, I personally think has got next to nothing to do with Brexit. It's simply that's a diesel model that isn't selling at all well in Europe, so they're not going to produce it anymore. But they're going to continue to make their more successful, environmentally friendly cars in Sunderland. Honda's decision to close its Swindon company production, again, I think is nothing to do with Brexit. Indeed, the company itself has said it's nothing to do with Brexit. It's due to the structural changes in the industry. So I think it is wrong to pin a lot of these individual stories on Brexit, but there's no doubt the uncertainty isn't helping. Good news, of course, is that as and when that uncertainty lifts, then I think actually a lot of those investment projects will turn out to have been, you know, delayed or postponed rather than cancelled completely. Investment will rebound. I think there's every chance too that consumer spending will accelerate. You know, as the one-off impact of the fall in the pound on inflation drops out, we're already starting to see consumers spending quite freely in the shops again. So I think over the next couple of years, actually the UK economy will outperform the rest of Europe in particular. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the damage that some people think has been done already will prove to have been temporary.
Victoria?
Yeah, I think that's got to be right. And I would like to hope that this particular announcement of tariffs is, although it's flagged as being a temporary measure, mm-hmm. and the bound rate of tariffs will stay as high as they currently are, so there is the potential that we could put tariffs back up in the next 12 months. But I like to hope that in fact this will be a stepping stone towards further liberalisation, whether or not that's by way of reaching free trade agreements with other countries, or whether it's more unilateral steps. And that could only help with all of those factors that Julian mentioned, in particular, you know, benefiting the consumer who ultimately pays the tariffs and would benefit from essentially a tax cut as and when the tariffs are removed.
Julian, if tariffs are ultimately a tax on consumers and removing them would be a clear win, do you think it comes down to it's just purely politics then to keep them there to protect vested interests?
I think there's a lot in that. There's partly a problem of how the gains and the losses are distributed. So the initial losses from removing trade barriers are likely to be concentrated amongst a relatively small number of firms and individuals, whereas the gains will be dispersed widely and more thinly, but across the whole of the rest of the population. The policy problem there, or the political problem there, is of course that those losers are better able to organise themselves into powerful lobby groups that are constantly saying that we need to keep these tariffs, we need to protect these jobs. Whereas consumers very rarely have voices as strong as that who are able to speak up for themselves. So it's much easier for politicians to worry about, you know, say, 3,000 job losses in, mm-hmm. in one particular part of the country, rather than to focus on the wider benefits for the economy as a whole, when mm-hmm. tens of millions of people might benefit from lower prices. So there is a problem here that, you know, the loudest voices aren't necessarily those that are most representative of the economy as a whole.
I mean, the merits of reducing the prices on things like food, clothing and footwear would be absolutely immense for the poorest in society, which, you know, affects a bigger proportion of their budget. But, you know, you mentioned the coal mining industry earlier. And if you think of communities like that in the Northeast, for example, there is still a lot of bitter resentment directed at Margaret Thatcher for that period, despite the fact you can argue, you know, other governments closed down more mines. But there is still this lingering resentment. How do you avoid that? How do you make sure that the losers are sufficiently compensated to an extent where they don't feel that it's free trade that is out to get them. It's globalization that is out to get them.
Well, I think even the most passionate advocate of unilateral free trade would recognize that it is important to protect the losers. It's not just enough to lower barriers and leave people to the wolves of free market forces. You need some sort of protection in there. Some of those things we do have, and we obviously have a, you know, welfare safety net that redistributes income through the tax and benefit system. Maybe that could be strengthened in some way. We also have other things that we can do, you know, keeping labour markets flexible, keeping the housing market flexible, and so on. But it's clearly important that people aren't left behind. People should be helped as far as possible to transition from one sector to another. Perhaps there are many parts of the country where the government hasn't been as good at doing that as it could otherwise have been. I, for one, would particularly prioritise things like retraining, education and skills to make it easier for people who have, you know, one set of skills that may now be redundant to move into new areas where new skills are required. So it's absolutely essential that people aren't left behind. For all sorts of reasons. Obviously, there's the, you know, economic efficiency arguments. You don't want a large pool of people sitting around doing nothing. But as you're also suggesting, there's also sort of social arguments about, you know, equity and so on. It's not fair to leave people behind in the way that, you know, some communities have undoubtedly suffered. So that's not an argument against free trade itself, but it is an argument for making sure that alongside free trade and other free market policies, you have a recognition that you need an effective safety net to help other people lift themselves out of poverty, if that is the trap they might otherwise fall into.
Victoria, going back to trade deals and, you know, the idea of a truly global Britain that's out there striking FTAs, are we going to lose out by having already unilaterally lowered our tariffs? Isn't it goods that matter?
Well, it's strange because a lot of the same people who will claim on the one hand that tariffs aren't the real issue, it's the non-tariff barriers that are the biggest problem with our relationship with the EU, will simultaneously argue that we shouldn't reduce our tariffs because that will hold us back in making deals with the rest of the world. And the reality is, as I alluded to earlier, the countries that have very low or no tariffs actually do very well in free trade agreements, and that's because they are very open to tackling the non-tariff barriers, the regulatory barriers, investment issues, and those are things where, as a very open economy, the UK could do very well at. And fundamentally, it comes back to this point that opening your market isn't just something you do to reciprocate benefits that you're seeking with another country. Opening your market is a benefit to this country. We benefit, the economy benefits, consumers benefit, and the more we do that, it's great if we can get reciprocal benefits for exporters, but ultimately we need to be open because that's a good thing on its own terms.
Julian?
Well, I'd absolutely agree with that. To me, tariffs are ultimately a tax on consumers, and removing them is a clear win, you know, regardless of what other countries do. If they are daft enough to want to continue to make their own consumers pay higher prices than they would otherwise have done, more for them. I'd also hope, of course, that we would be setting an example that, you know, if the UK lowers its tariffs unilaterally and the UK economy thrives as a result, then surely people and voters in other countries will look at this example and ask their government, well, why aren't you doing the same thing? I mean, you know, if the UK is benefiting from lowering tariffs unilaterally, then why shouldn't we be doing so?
Well, and I would add as well, another benefit of taking unilateral steps and reducing and eliminating tariffs is that it also makes the process of importing goods, the mechanics of the process, much simpler and carries less risk. And that's been another issue that's been discussed at length, and the project fee has been cranked up massively in terms of the customs processing element of it, the filling in of customs declarations, meeting rules of origin, which all carries risk to the importer and fiscal cost. Now, the fewer tariffs you have, the lower the complexity. You don't have to worry about meeting rules of origin because you don't have to prove where the goods come from if no tariff attaches to them. And the formalities and compliance issues become much less onerous. And that's, we know from the discussions about the Irish border and the ports at Dover and Calais, what a live issue that's become. So this is, you know, this is actually a really great step in that direction as well.
Yeah. I mean, Julian, though, aren't we on a sort of ideological hiding to nothing? Because 80% of our imports are already tariff-free, and eliminating the remaining lot might only reduce consumer prices by about 1%.
Well, I think that's one of those things that is a good example of something that's factually true but actually misleading. It is correct that the bulk of our imports are already tariff-free, but that doesn't mean that we couldn't do significantly better. Suppose, for example, we're importing a particular good tariff-free from one country, we might still be able to buy it more cheaply from elsewhere if tariffs were removed on imports from other countries that can produce them more efficiently. So yes, I mean, obviously we tend to import goods from countries where we don't have a tariff, but maybe we could do better importing them from other countries if tariffs were removed across the board. What's more, if you lower tariffs on imports in the rest of the world, you're not just lowering the prices of those goods, you're preventing you from having to do something else which will be even worse, which is to impose tariffs for the first time on imports from the European Union. So as long as we have the, you know, zero tariffs on imports from the rest of the world, we don't have to impose tariffs on our trade with our biggest single trading partner. So there's a big win there. Plus, as Victoria was alluding to, one of the main reasons why you have non-tariff barriers is actually precisely to police tariffs. So that would significantly ease the disruption at ports and so on. That in turn, I think, would limit the downside for the pound from leaving without a deal. It's possible actually that this is one of the things that might see the pound recover. So for those people that are concerned that any benefit from reducing tariffs could be offset by a further fall in the pound, well, if you have a sort of, you know, hard but smart Brexit that sets the right levels of tariffs, which were as low as possible, then that could actually be seen as a net benefit for the economy and actually help sterling to recover, not least because the currency is already priced in so much bad news.
Do you agree with that, Victoria?
I do. I think the argument that we already import most of our goods from countries that we already have free trade agreements with is very self-serving. Of course we do. That's why you have free trade agreements and customs unions, is to direct the trade and essentially to distort the trade in that direction. That in itself is not an economically efficient way to carry out international trade. And so it also means that you are reducing the competition in the market for protected good. So the price increase that consumers pay isn't just the fiscal cost of the tariff, it's also caused by the lack of competition that's forced upon the sector or the good concerned by virtue of having a tariff attached to it. Mm-hmm. So there is a dynamic effect that will undoubtedly occur that I think the whole 80%, 87% thing doesn't account for at all.
I think to end, I want to ask you both, I think you're both in agreement, and I want you to respond with a yes or a no. I think you're both in agreement that the ambition should be to eliminate the bulk of our remaining tariffs as soon as possible, whether or not we have a deal. But I want to know, how optimistic are you that actually we will embark on the kind of free trade future that you both actually think would be good for consumers in this country?
Well, the elephant in the room that we haven't really discussed, although you touched on it in your introduction, Darren, is everything we've discussed today is contingent mm-hmm. on a no deal outcome.
Absolutely.
So that's the first very important condition. And I think the other slight shadow on this is that although broadly speaking it's in a positive liberalizing direction, there are some worrying signs still of protectionism and listening to vested interests and trying to pursue mercantilist aims. So I think on balance, the glass is maybe half full.
Okay, Julian?
I think that's a good way of looking at it. As a professional economist, I find a lot of the debate around this disappointing, not least because I thought that this argument was won hundreds of years ago. Mm. You know, the work of Adam Smith and Ricardo and the practical experience, for example, of removing the corn laws in the UK. And yet, as an economist, I when I go out and make these arguments about free trade, I often find it's other economists who are most vociferous and coming back to me and saying that this would wipe out British manufacturing or agriculture, or, you know, we must prioritise protecting the jobs we currently have rather than thinking about the interests of consumers. So if it's a hard sell for one economist to convince another economist, I can see why it's even harder for economists to convince the general public or policymakers, particularly when there are such powerful lobby groups working hard on the other side to protect the interests of what ultimately are a handful of producers. So it is a hard fight, and in that sense I'm not optimistic, but That's not, of course, a reason to give up. I think these things do go in cycles at the moment. Brexit does represent a golden opportunity for somebody to stand up as a champion for global free trade again. And I very much, of course, hope it will be the UK.
Well, come on, with the pair of you, I'm sure we can do it. I'm sure we can lead that charge. Let's hope that anyone listening that is in a position of power will be on the side of the consumers. And let's start lowering those barriers to trade and reducing prices for the poorest in society. Victoria and Julian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For more films, podcasts and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.